I'm going to read verses 11 over to verse 16. Revelation 19, 11 to 16. Actually, let me go back to verse 9 of Revelation 19. And the angel said to me, write thus, blessed are those who are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he said to me, these are the true words of God. Then I fell down at his feet to worship him, but he said to me, you must not do that. I am a fellow servant with you and your brothers who hold to the testimony of Jesus. Worship God. The testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy. Then I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse. The one sitting on it is called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and makes war. His eyes are like a flame of fire, and on his head are many diadems, and he has a name written that no one knows but himself. He is clothed in a robe dipped in blood, and the name by which he is called is the Word of God. And the armies of heaven, arrayed in fine linen, white and pure, were following him on white horses. From his mouth comes a sharp sword which to strike down the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron. He will tread the winepress of the fury of the wrath of God the Almighty. On his robe and on his thigh, he has a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Well, we want to come this morning to consider Constantine and the revolution that he brings into the life of the church and the significant changes that he brings into that whole realm that we describe as the relationship between church and state. I want to preface my remarks by this. When you choose a book to work through, as we have doing, or if you choose a textbook, I'm obviously involved in that, you choose textbooks for courses, and it doesn't mean that everything in the textbook you agree with. And invariably there will be things you maybe thought the author could have put better, things he left out, things he should have included then, and things you just plain disagree with. And in the section in which Timothy Paul Jones deals with Constantine, I plainly disagree with him in his fundamental take on Constantine. And but I'll get into that in a second. The other preparatory remark I want to make is that the statement I just read was written in the Roman Empire. It was written by common consensus somewhere towards the end of the first century A.D. There are scholars who argue that all of the New Testament was written before 70 A.D. 70 A.D. is a critical date because that's the date of the fall of Jerusalem. In 66 A.D., the Jews in Judea revolted en masse, and there was what's called the Jewish War, which ran from 66 to 73. It ends in 73 with the Roman legions besieging the last of the Jewish opposition at Masada. One speaks of history influencing the present, even today, or at least up until very recently, I'm sure it's still the same today, all new military units in the Israeli army are sworn in on the height of Masada. And it's a very, very powerful, potent site in which they remember that determination to rid themselves of a foreign occupying power. And there are some who argue, and I'm not one of them, that all of the New Testament was written before 70 A.D. I think Revelation is written later. I think there is good evidence that John survived into the 80s, maybe even the 90s A.D., and Revelation was written at that period of time. Whether it was written prior to 70, whether it was written in 20 years after that, is neither here nor there to the point that I want to make. The point that I want to make is the world of which John wrote this book was a world in which there was only one King of Kings and Lord of Lords in the larger political world, and that was the emperor. And sometimes today I think we fail to understand how deeply political is the statement, Jesus is Lord. That is a profoundly political statement. As soon as I say that, I'm relegating every political power in this world to a lower status. Now, we can say that in a democracy, and nobody really gets up in arms about it. Well, there are people who are up in arms about it to some degree, but we're not disturbing the government profoundly when we say Jesus is Lord, and we reiterate that. And but you live in a dictatorship, and you are saying something that threatens the rule of the dictator. Because we are saying that he is not a law unto himself. We're saying that he can't go about doing whatever he wants. He is answerable ultimately to another. And so I sometimes think that, and I've come to think, you're quite free to disagree with me on this, that contemporary evangelicalism in North America, part of it anyway, has failed to grasp at times the deeply political nature of what we're about. We are proclaiming a new order, one in which Jesus is Lord. Now, what we're not about is what other religious groups, I'm thinking here obviously of Islam, is about, which is bringing in that order through violence, through military power, through political power. Jesus makes that very clear when he stands before Pontius Pilate. And Pilate says, "Oh, well, you're a king, eh?" And Jesus tells him that if he were a king like other kings in one sense in this world, he would have armies to fight for him. And in fact, he could, if he wanted, call his angels. But his kingdom is proceeding in to develop and grow at a very, very, in a very, very different style. But nonetheless, that is a political challenge when Jesus basically affirms he is king of the Jews in one sense, rightly so, in this statement here, that Jesus is King of kings and Lord of lords. He is the Lord of all the nations. And all political powers ultimately one day will recognize him, willingly or unwillingly, as the rightful Lord of all. And so I mention that, and I don't want to get bogged down in a discussion of how Christians are involved in how we view politics in that sense, but that Christianity, right from the get-go, has been making statements that are understood as political statements. And Christianity is involved in the political realm by the very nature of its truth claims. And there have been, down through the history of the church, significant figures who have been political rulers who have been Christians. And we're going to look today at one of the most controversial, which is Constantine. And there are different ways of looking at him, broadly two ways, and I'm going to sketch the one, which is Timothy Paul Jones, then I'll elaborate, which is what I think my perspective, not what I think, what I know is my perspective on Constantine. I say this because whenever, it's important to recognize that whenever you deal with Christians who are active in the political realm, you're going to have different takes on them. And I'm not of the opinion that politics is dirty business. And I sometimes, you know, Christians have a very negative view of the political realm. And that because I think God calls certain individuals to be involved in the political realm. And we hope and pray for godly rulers and for people who take the law of God seriously. And politicians who are motivated by truth and righteousness. And whenever a Christian goes into the political realm, though, there are decisions that have to be made, difficult decisions, and different ways of viewing him. For instance, I have some very close Irish friends who are absolutely amazed that I could ever have written a book, which I did, on the piety or the spirituality of Oliver Cromwell. They find it inconceivable. And I was actually with a brother last year. He's a Reformed brother, Baptist. He finds it inconceivable for me to think that Oliver Cromwell was actually a spiritually minded man. And Cromwell is a deeply, maybe not over here, he is a deeply controversial figure. When in the UK, when his the last remnant of his body, which was his head, his skull, was buried in 1960. It's an interesting story. I won't get into the details of it. There is a book, if you're interested, there's a book called Cromwell's Head, which I picked up about 3 years ago in England. I thought, brilliant. This is a whole book on the story of his head. What happened to when he got his head chopped, when he got his head decapitated, and it was passed down. So, anyway, it was eventually buried in the vestry or the quad. Well, not the quad, the entrance of Sidney Sussex College in Cambridge University, where he had matriculated. And if you go there, you go into the, it's beautiful, one of these beautiful Cambridge colleges, you go into the main area where the entrance to the school, the college, and there is a sign there that says, within 20 feet of where you are standing, the head of Oliver Cromwell, the one-time protector of the English nation, is buried. It doesn't tell you exactly where. Because when it was eventually buried, the people who buried it did not want the possibility, if it was known exactly, of it being dug up and things being done to it. And that's because Cromwell was a very controversial figure. So whenever a Christian goes into politics, there is always that. Things are said, things are done that others will disagree with. And Constantine is another very, very controversial figure. Timothy Paul Jones' take on Constantine basically is that he's a man who's confused. If you have the book, we do have more books, by the way. I have 10 more books, which I'll give to Adam. So if you are lacking a book or you want another copy, then you can see Adam after the end of the service or the end of the Sunday school. The pages, it's roughly pages 36 to 38 is where he deals with Constantine. And he describes Constantine this way. In Constantine's mind, this is the second paragraph on page 38, Constantine's mind, Christ was now his personal patron. And he's using a word there. You may remember when we looked at Cyprian briefly, one of the things I talked about with Cyprian, the North African bishop, was that he had once been occupied a very wealthy position in the Roman society. He was what was called a patron. Patrons and clients was integral to the structure of the Roman world, where you had very wealthy individuals who had maybe 50 to 100, maybe a few hundred, maybe even as many as a few thousand, if they were really very wealthy, families who were dependent on them. And the heads of those households, the men would turn up every morning to greet this the patron, and the relationship was on a mutual benefit. And that's the idea that Timothy Paul Jones is picking up here. And I don't dispute that. In Constantine's mind, Christ was now his personal patron. The cross, once an emblem of Christ's death, began to function as a charm confirming Constantine's power. Constantine granted church leaders, now commonly called priests, I would disagree with that too, but that's off to the side, widespread favors. Constantine sincerely believed he was a Christian, yet he seems to worship Jesus as the sun god. In some ways, his confusion made sense. Didn't Christians call Jesus the son of righteousness, Malachi 4:2, and wasn't Jesus the light of the world? Christians even worshipped on Sunday. And he depicts Constantine here as very confused. He does note that he sincerely believed he was a Christian. And Timothy Paul Jones's mind, a significant confusion in Constantine's mind. That's what I'm going to dispute in a minute. Timothy Paul Jones's take on Constantine is mild compared to others. In recent days, there have been a spate of books on Constantine, partly because of Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. And if you happen to have it, I didn't read the book completely. I read enough to know that the book was, I couldn't believe a book like this would sell millions of copies. That's disturbing. That alone just tells you what the reading public is like out there. But Dan Brown argues in his book, and the height of the book is that is when he gets to the chapter dealing with Constantine, and it's a fictional novel, but in it he argues implicitly through the various fictional characters that Constantine is the one who introduced radical changes in Christianity. Nobody worshipped Jesus before Constantine came along. Constantine brings in the Trinity and a variety of things like this and imposes this by state power. And he himself was certainly not a genuine Christian. And all of this is, I think all of this has great significance for us today. The main significance, which I'm going to emphasize, is the whole issue of church and state relations. But it has other ongoing residual effects. I was at an evangelistic event last Wednesday at the University of Louisville. And afterwards, somebody came up to talk to me. And within probably 5 minutes, I realized the guy was a Jehovah's Witness. And he got going on a rant. He really didn't want to ask me any questions. He was going on a rant about Constantine. And I had to listen to 15 minutes. I couldn't get a word in edgewise. And but a lot of it was Constantine. And Constantine was the big baddie, and he introduced a thing called Christendom. And I was in Christendom, and I had to come out of Christendom. And he got going on the Trinity, and at that point, I just bluntly interrupted him. And anyway, here it is, 1700 years later, and Constantine's still rumbling around. He's still having an impact. You know, Dan Brown, people are all reading the book. This particular gentleman, his own take on him. And what is the significance of Constantine, and what did he actually believe? Very quickly, what I want to do, and I've used up a good portion of my time, I want to look at Constantine's career very quickly. I want to ask, what did he think he was about? And then I want to look at the significance of Constantine in the history of the church. Constantine was groomed for power. There's no doubt about that. His father, Constantius, was one of the Roman emperors. And during the reign of, during the 3rd century, the period of time when we were looking at Cyprian, the Roman Empire was in serious, serious trouble. Between 220 and 284, that's about 65 years, there were about 30 to 35 emperors. And no offense to Italians and lovers of the contemporary Italian political scene, but if you know anything about Italian politics since the end of the Second World War, the Roman Empire kind of looked like that. The government's always falling. It's always in crisis. I don't know how many prime ministers they've had, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the Roman world was like that. I mean, it is not a good thing in 65 years you got 35 men who claim to be the emperor, which means they're not lasting that long. And of those 30, 35, only two died in their beds. The rest of them died violently. And the Roman world was in a mess. And one of the great historical questions is why Rome did not fall as an imperial power in the middle of the 3rd century, but it hung on to the end of the into the 5th century. But that's not an issue we want to deal with today. At the end of that period, roughly from 220 to 284, an emperor emerges named Diocletian. And he became the emperor because he challenged the previous emperor, marched on Rome with his legions. The guy went out to meet him. And instead of a pitched battle, the previous emperor said, agreed to go out and talk to Diocletian between the two armies. He shouldn't have done that. He should have known the sort of man he was dealing with, because Diocletian had been a general, one of his generals, for quite a while. And the guy comes out to have a parley, and Diocletian, at a moment when the other man wasn't looking, whips his sword out, takes the guy's head off. And his legions decide, well, the emperor's dead, we're not going to fight for a dead emperor. And they all go over to Diocletian's side. He's now the emperor. And if you'd been living at the time, you'd have thought, well, this guy's, you know, he's just one in a long line of all these characters. And he'll be gone in 2 years, too. He lasted from 284 to 305, 21 years. Doesn't sound like a long time, but in that time he was able to reconstruct the foundations of the Roman world, economically, politically, militarily, a variety of things. And one of the problems he saw, which was a very evident problem in the third century, was how to pass on power peacefully instead of people violently taking it. And so he came up with this idea that what he would do is he'd divide the empire into two major administrative sections, the east and the west, and the line of division ran down roughly the Adriatic between Italy and Greece. And the east was Greek-speaking primarily, the west was Latin-speaking. So there's two major divisions administratively. They both have an emperor who would make all decisions jointly. That was the ideal. And then below them, they had what we would describe today as a vice emperor. They actually called the emperor an Augustus, and the vice emperor was a Caesar. And at a certain point in time, the emperor would step down, and he would be succeeded by the Caesar. And it sounded like a brilliant plan. It actually did work once. And he took the Eastern Empire. He appointed as his co-regent in the West, one of his generals, a man named Maximian, the guy who was fervently loyal to him. And then they had as their vice emperors, the Caesar, in the East, it was a man named Galerius under Diocletian. And in the West, it was Constantius, the father of Constantine. In the year 305, 2 years after Diocletian had initiated a vicious persecution against the church, he suddenly abdicated, the only Roman emperor ever to do this. And he said, we're going to put into effect that arrangement that we had agreed to, and I'm stepping down. And he went to live in a place called Split, which is now, I think it's in Bosnia, on the Adriatic. And you can actually apparently still go to Split. I had a friend who's working as a missionary there. And up until probably 15 years ago, there was a large palace where Diocletian went to live. And you could still pick up Roman relics, coins that would be lying around if you dug down deep enough in the soil. And people used to do that until the Bosnians figured out, hey, there's money to be made out of this. So they've kind of made it into a tourist site. And Diocletian resigned being emperor and went and spent the rest of his life, about 10 years or so, growing cabbages. And the only Roman emperor ever to personally abdicate. All the others either died violently or died in their beds. And Maximian stepped down and Galerius became emperor in his stead. And in the West, it was Constantius, the father of Constantine. And Constantius only lasted a year, and he died in the year 306. In that year, the troops of Constantius in the city of Eboracum, which is actually the English city of York. If you go to York today, there are some of the old Roman walls that are still there, and you can actually see the Roman wall. You can touch it, in front of which the troops of Constantine declared him the emperor of the West. And there were those who disputed it, and Constantine finds himself involved for 6 years in war to secure his claims. The final battle he engages in is a battle at the place called the Milvian Bridge, one of the bridges leading into Rome. Before the battle, we're told, and he would tell this story about 30 years later to a man named Eusebius of Caesarea. Before the battle, he said, I had a vision. And I saw Christ. And a sign that Christ told me to put on the shields of my soldiers and almost definitely on the standards, the Roman standard. Every Roman legion had a standard. And the standard was adorned with two things. Number one, images of Roman gods. And it was adorned with little plaques that indicated the campaigns and battles they had taken place in. And the guy who carried the standard, the aquifer, was a very important figure. And he was usually identified by wearing a leopard skin over the top of his armor. And you could never allow the standard or the eagle to fall into the hands of the enemy. And Constantine almost definitely stripped the standards of the pagan images and put a Christian image on them. And in Timothy Paul Jones, he shows you what the image looked like. It's called the Cairo. It's a very, very old Christian symbol. And it's the first two letters in Greek of Christ's name, Christos, a thing that looks like an X. It's actually a CH. And the thing that looks like a P is an R, Christos. And that's called the Cairo symbol. And he put that on the standards of the troops as they went in to fight that day. And what you need to recognize is that the army, Constantine's a dictator, as are all the Roman emperors. What you need, as you can, if you've been following any of the events in recent days in Tunisia, then Egypt, now Libya, what's critical to the survival of a dictator is the army. In the, in Egypt, as you know, the army didn't stand with Mubarak. And who knows what's going on in Libya. And but a dictator cannot survive without the military power. The military in the Roman world was thoroughly, almost completely in terms of its leadership, pagan. And one of the reasons why I think Constantine was in his own mind genuine was because it's absolute total political suicide to lose the support of the army. You know, all these pagan guys, they have the personal loyalty generally of the legions. For him to stick a Christian symbol on those standards is absolutely, totally, politically nuts. And but he did. He must have been a very charismatic figure. There are, in the history of the world, individuals who are remarkably charismatic men. If you ever read any of the, if you read the history of the American Civil War, and you read about the way the some of the Southern armies, the Army of Virginia, the Northern Virginia, viewed Robert E. Lee, who probably was a Christian. There was this devotion to him that went far and above beyond the call of duty. There are men like that. Alexander the Great was probably like that. Can instill enormous devotion in men. And Constantine must have been able to do that because he puts the Christian symbol on the standards. They fight that day. They win the battle that day. And Constantine now is the sole ruler in the West. He'll eventually go on to conquer the whole empire. He basically destroys Diocletian's arrangement, and he becomes the sole ruler of the empire by 325. Now, what I'd like to do, and I'd like to look at, that's a very quick overview of his career. He is a man who grew up used to power. He knows how to exercise power, and sometimes he does it brutally. On one occasion, after his coming to power, after the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, he suspects a plot within his family, and he executes two of his sons. Just bang. Just takes them out, chops their heads off, because he thinks he's got credible evidence. And so he knows about how to deal with power. That's the world he lives in. He doesn't live in a democracy. And so some scholars have looked at that and say, well, look, you know, some of these things don't square. on the other hand, you've got an enormous amount of legislation and documentary evidence that speak differently. And I want to just run through that. And you can make your own mind up as you listen to what I'm saying. I do believe, when I first began to teach the early church in any sort of context, back in the early 1980s, I believe Constantine was, I thought he was used the church. I really didn't think he was genuine. And then I read a book which basically did in great detail what I'm going to do very, very sketchily. It said, the author, Timothy Barnes, who used to teach classics at the University of Toronto, said, why don't we just look at what he did and ask the question, what would motivate a man to do this legislation? And then why don't we look at what he said, rather than simply looking at what are the effects of his reign to determine where he may have been. So, what did he do? Well, almost immediately, 313, he comes to power, declares Christianity a tolerated religion. It is no longer, the Roman state will no longer persecute the church. Christians constitute 10%, maybe at a stretch, 12% of the empire. Very few of them. Some of them are fairly influential. Most of them are people like Constantine in his position, they're nobody. They're slaves. There are people from the lower classes. They're not the movers and shakers of the Roman world. Why would you identify yourself? Why would you give toleration to this group of people? What gain is it politically? Remember, he's a dictator, and if it's all a smart political move, why would he do that? Then, over the course of between 313 and 325, he does a number of things. For instance, quite a number of churches have been destroyed by the persecution of Diocletian. He gives money to the churches to rebuild. This is actually the beginning of the building of the Vatican in Rome. The church in Rome, he gives enormous amounts of funds, and they actually build a building that can house 6,000 people. And there's a radical change in worship that takes place, because suddenly you go from congregations of 120 to 6,000, the first quote-unquote megachurches. Why would he do that? Why would he, as he did, grant no taxes for anybody who was an elder, bishop, or a deacon in the churches in the empire? Nobody had tax-free status except the emperor's immediate household. Even all the great generals, all the senators, all paid taxes. He comes in, and the reason why we have ministers today have any sort of tax break is because of ultimately Constantine. Because he comes in and said, no taxes for any elders, bishops, deacons. Why would he do that? Why would he make, and he did, he made divorce very difficult. And there are only a few reasons given why you could divorce. For instance, if a woman found out her husband, there were three reasons that he gave for divorce. The biblical ones, and then he added onto the biblical ones, if you found out your husband was a tomb violator. Don't ask me why. Must have been common. He was, in other words, in the dead of the night, he was hanging around cemeteries, breaking open tombs to kind of find loot. You know, anything people were buried with. And if you found out your husband was a tomb violator, you could proceed with divorce. It must have been a very serious issue. But he made divorce and remarriage very, very difficult. In the Roman world, prior to Constantine, if you were 16 years old, a woman, unmarried, you were fined every year. If you were married and you didn't have a child, you are fined. And the reason's obvious. The same reason that you find in Nazi Germany in the 1930s, where German women were rewarded financially with having babies. Or recently, I mean, in Quebec, I think. Quebec has a ruling like that. And it's because you've got a fear. We're getting overwhelmed here. We've got to encourage the women to have more sons or more children. And therefore, if you were a woman not married at 16, you are fined. If you were married, you were still fined, but it was a lighter fine. If you were male, not married at 18, you were fined, and a lighter fine if you didn't have children. Well, Constantine banned that because he recognized, it would appear, that within the New Testament there is room for people not to be married. Some have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of Christ's sake. He banned crucifixion as a form of capital punishment. That's the only one. He banned gladiatorial games. It took him a while to get that one through, and it was never completely all done through the empire, but he banned in Rome the gladiatorial games. I mean, that is a... I don't know if we'd experience here in Canada the sort of things we've seen in Egypt and Tunisia if the government tomorrow... I need to be careful on this because I'm really no lover of this particular item. If tomorrow the government passed a law banning hockey. No more hockey games. The whole thing shut down. I'll desist from significant comment about this. But, I mean, what is this guy thinking of? I mean, the gladiatorial games have been around for 500 years. They're part of the staple of Roman life. This is the way you make sure that the mobs and
are rioting. You send them all off to the arena where they can get their fill of blood, give them bread while they're there, and then they're happy. You know, watching people getting killed around and killing people. So, good way of dealing with Roman mobs. Well, he bans them. Now, he replaces them. He's got some political sense. He replaces them with chariot racing. And so you get the emergence of these various teams of chariot racers. The reds, the greens, the blues, and the whites, I think there were the four teams. And apparently there used to be riots if one of the groups failed and didn't win. And so the mob still got to, you know, got their share of blood or whatever. But at least chariot racing wasn't designed to kill people. And then what he did, and this you need to view this from the way I personally view, for instance, what's happened in Britain, the granting of Sharia law to certain communities. In London, I think there's six communities, London, Birmingham, Bradford, maybe in Glasgow, where if you're in a Muslim community, you can actually have Sharia law deal with divorce issues, marriage issues. It'll come here, just a matter of time. We're going to face that issue. And it's horrifying. I think it's absolutely horrifying to erect another system of law alongside our present system. Well, what Constantine did was, he said, if you were a Christian and you had a legal case and you didn't want to go before a pagan judge, you could take it before a bishop. He gave bishops civil power. Now, long term, this ain't good. But I wonder if he's thinking, why would he do this? And then on top of that, he actually had bishops come, stay with him, hang around the palace all the time to advise him. And the comparison would be, you know, if Prime Minister Harper said to our pastor, well, you know, I'd like you to come up to Ottawa, I'll say 2 weeks out of every month, I'll fly you up, put you up in an apartment, and you can tell me how to run the country. Like 90% of the empire's pagan. Like they're thinking like, what the heck is going on here? And then finally he, and I'm going to get now very quickly to two statements he made. Finally he says, Rome is such a city associated with paganism, I'm leaving Rome, and I'm going to go over to Constantinople. He founds almost a new capital because he said Rome is stained with the blood of the martyrs. And he founds Constantinople on the Bosphorus, which is now modern Turkey. And then two statements. These statements are both of them quite shocking statements. In 325, he issued a declaration that had a number of things in it. But one of the things he said in it was that, as far as he was concerned, every emperor before him, except the one, namely his father, was in hell. Because they were pagans and they persecuted the church. That is a very shocking political statement. Because all the Roman emperors, even if they thought the previous emperor was a nutcase, and they often did, they at least acknowledged, you know, there's been a succession and many of these guys, they're good guys, but whatever. And that's a very shocking statement for him to make. All the previous emperors, he says, basically are in hell. And deservedly so, because they did not worship the true God. God, he says, he actually at one point in the document prays to God. He says, your name I truly love, and I regard with reverence that power of which you have given abundant proofs to the increase of my faith. But probably the most significant statement is the following. One of the great neighboring power to the east of the Roman Empire is the Persian Empire. And the king at this time is a man named Sapor the First. He was a vicious persecutor of Christians in Persia. In the 320s, Constantine wrote to him. And the context in which you've got to put this is one of the problems that I think that has emerged in the whole situation in the Middle East in terms of the West, how the West has been involved in some of these Middle Eastern countries. And
a guy like, for instance, Mubarak, who obviously a Muslim, but no friend of Muslim terrorism, and therefore has been propped up to some degree by the West, and we're in real problems, I think, in some of these contexts. And the statement I'm about to read, you need to put into contemporary context, like, if George W. Bush had written to King Faisal of Saudi Arabia, which he didn't, and Bush was a professing evangelical, and as far as I can tell, he's a professing evangelical. If he had told him, to King Faisal, you touch one Christian in Saudi Arabia, you'll have me and the entire American army to answer to. He never did that. This is Constantine writing to King Sapor. He's found out Sapor is killing Christians. He says, I profess the most holy religion. I confess that as a disciple of the holy God, I observe this worship. With the power of this God on my side to help me, I'm beginning at the boundaries of the ocean, at the Atlantic. All the Romans knew that there's nothing beyond the Atlantic. It's the end of the world. I have gathered every nation one after another throughout the world with a certain hope of salvation. This God I worship, my army is dedicated to him, wears his sign on their shoulders, marching directly wherever the cause of justice summons them. I confess, I honor this God with never dying remembrance. This God in the height of his glory, I delight to contemplate with a pure and simple heart. And in the text, he's basically telling the guy, it's a subtle threat. You touch any Christians, and we're coming in there. And when I've gone through this, I've had to think, you know, we've had political rulers in the West, like President Bush, claiming to be Christians, and let's take their claims at face value. They've never said anything like that. And obviously the reason they haven't said anything like that is because they need Saudi support for anti-terrorist activities and the problem with Iran and oil, and politics makes strange bedfellows. Whatever you say about Constantine in terms of, okay, all of the things he did with the empire got political ramifications to help him, this is no political kudos of this. He's not winning any points. Most likely he's going to get himself involved in a war. Why would he say a thing like that? Now, that's some of the documentary evidence that convinces me personally. Now, we may get to heaven, and the heavens and earth, and he ain't there. And you can say, Michael, man, you were dead wrong on that one. You can tell me till the cows come home at that point, and I won't be bothered at all, will I? I mean, I don't know. As I said, I think last week, I've got problems sometimes trying to figure out where the person coming across to me is when I'm talking to them, let alone some guy being dead 1,700 years. And in a very different world, very different culture. But if we take what he said politically and what he did as evidence, he seems to think he's a Christian. Having said that, there's one final question, which is very quick, that I need to run through. What does this mean for the church? Well, long term, it's dreadful. Politics makes strange bedfellows. And Christians need to be involved in the political realm without a shadow of a doubt. But this marriage of what Constantine does here is a marriage of church and state. And it's still with us in certain ways. We're not Anglicans, but if we were Anglicans, the head of our church would be Queen Elizabeth, not the Archbishop of Canterbury, who is a bit of a dead loss. But the Queen. What is the Queen doing the head of the church? Well, it's Constantine, isn't it? And the interweaving of church and state has done nothing good, I think, ultimately for the church. Should individual Christians be involved in the political realm? Yes, without a shadow of a doubt. We're called to bear witness to the grace of God, the law of God, the righteousness of God, truth and justice in every realm of life. Should the church be wedded to the state? No. And that's what Constantine does. And the long-term results, as we will see them, are negative. And we're still living with the effects of that. I think one of the reasons why, it's not the only reason, but one reason why Europe
is so deeply secularized is because of this marriage of church and state. Because even in European countries today, in your taxes, you're paying for the support of that local unbelieving Christian, unbelieving pastor of a so-called Christian church down the road. And people are still paying for the support of pastors in their taxes. And it goes back to this union of church and state. Anyway, that's a very quick overview. It's a fascinating subject in many respects. It's not simply academic. It has impact upon us where we are today. And we'll see that impact as we look at the history of the church. This is a revolution that changes the whole fabric of the church's life. Very quickly, we have just a minute or so. Any questions before we conclude?
When Rome and Italy kind of split there, Constantine at the beginning was not a believer. The first battle where he was trying to overcome power, because he didn't have much at the beginning, to my understanding, he lost. There was one military advisor he had who was a believer, and the rest were, like many Romans, not. He blamed the loss of that battle on because the sort of believing military advisor was kind of the outcast. He was still allowed to come along, but no one really took him very seriously because of his beliefs. He then constantly got so upset with the military advisors that he had lost that battle. And then next time he went to battle, he asked the advice of the believing advisor, then told him, listen, all these pagan symbols, whatnot, on your armor, they've got to go. Then you have to, I think was it a blue cross or something?
No, it's actually it's the one that, you don't have a book there, but it's the Cairo symbol.
Constantine basically said, okay, well, if I take your advice, and you're wrong, you're done. But if I take your advice and you're right, I'll be taking your advice. And then the next battle he did, in fact, have his whole military do what that military advisor had done.
Yeah, I mean,
and they won that battle. I would understand.
There is to some degree, Constantine sees the proof of his faith in his military victories. There's no doubt about that to some degree. But Constantine's father, there's questions about Constantine's father's own religious convictions, because Constantine's father, one of Constantine's sisters is called Anastasia, which means resurrection. And no pagan would ever name their daughter that. So there's been Christian influence in the home growing up somehow. So he's a complex man, it's a complex issue. And I do think, though, as he comes to power, that he sees himself as a Christian. Next week, very quickly, I want to stay in the same chapter, and I want to go over to the Creed of Nicaea. And so it's pages 38 to 41 is what I'm going to look at. So if you want to read that, it's the Arian controversy, Athanasius and the Nicene Creed. Let's close in prayer. Father, we are thankful that you have set your Son at your right hand, made him and declared him, as we read in your holy word, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And we are thankful that in the mix of this world, that there is coming a great day when the nations of this earth will bow to the Christ. And his reign of perfect righteousness will be established. Help us to be witnesses in whatever sphere you've called us to be till that day. Bless the word as it is preached in the hour to come. For Jesus' sake. Amen.